Hi, my name is Lou Johnson. I'm a statistician and a process engineer. I work for the National Center for Nanotechnology Utilization and Education, and I'm here today to talk to you about process variability with respect to nanotechnology manufacturing processes and how we understand and control that variability in order to make the best products for our customers. Now, the topics we'll be talking about today will revolve around understanding variation and comparing that variation to customer specifications, and we call that comparison a process capability calculation. The topics we'll be covering today are variation and its relationship to quality. In other words, we're going to ask you to think about variation in a little bit different way than most manufacturers think about variability. We'll talk about the normal distribution as a model to describe that variation so that we can quantify it and visualize it and understand it. We'll compare the amount of variation to specifications. The two main ways that we do that are through calculation of capability indices that we call CP and CPK. And then finally, we'll extend those concepts of CP and CPK onto what we call the long-term process capability, performance capability calculation called PPK. I'd like to start with asking you to think about quality in a little bit different way than most folks think about quality. The traditional definition of quality is possessing one or more functional capabilities, attributes, or performance enhancements that we say are associated with a higher quality product, and then a lower quality product will not have as much functionality, as much capability, and cannot do the same types of things that a higher product quality product would have. A good example of this might be the i3 versus the i5 processor. The i5 processor, core processor from Intel, it's going to have a larger amount of memory or memory cores. It'll have more cache memory, and it will also have a turbo boost feature that will allow the i5 to perform in a way that the i3 cannot perform. Because it has these additional functionalities, we say that the i5 has higher quality than the i3. We also are willing to pay a higher price for the i5 than the i3. So that's a traditional view of quality. What I'd like you to do is think about a fellow named Michael Close, who works for a company called Cormatech. And Cormatech manufactures molten metal filters used in the steel forging industry. Michael is going to bring in raw materials into his manufacturing process, and he's going to process those materials into his final product. And he knows that the acetate content of those batches of raw materials have a direct relationship to the ability of him to use those materials in his production. So what Mike is going to do, he's going to develop a process to try to standardize the amount of acetate, because the raw material supplier is not able to control the amount of acetate and provide a low variability with respect to that particular characteristic. A direct quote from Mike might be that, "I don't care where they set the acetate level, I just wish they would keep it the same." And what he meant by that was that he can adapt his process to any acetate level that they see in the raw materials. What he can't do is keep adjusting his process batch after batch after batch to keep chasing highly variable acetate content from his supplier. Now let's take that concept of low variation, meaning high quality, to an engineer like Michael Close and what he's trying to do at Cormatech. Let's apply it to a nanotechnology situation such as that we see from Helix Material Solution. Helix Material Solutions manufactures nanotubes that are used by many manufacturing organizations to add unique electrical, thermal, and structural properties to the products that they manufacture. So Helix's goal is to try to provide as high a quality raw material to each one of their customers as possible. Now, those unique thermal, electrical, and structural properties of the carbon nanotubes are a direct function of the ratio of volume to surface area of those nanotubes that they're manufacturing. Because that ratio of volume to surface area is so critical, and the volume and the surface area of these cylinders are a function of the diameter of the cylinders, Helix is going to focus on the variability in the diameter of those particular nanotubes as a key indicator of the quality of their product with respect to their customers' use of the product in their customers' manufacturing operations. Because of this, Helix is going to be highly interested in and very much concerned with monitoring, controlling, and reducing the variability in the nanotubes that they manufacture. So let's have a look at some data from Helix. We'll take some data over time. Here we see a data set that looks at sampling the process over time. And you can see every few minutes, we'll take another sample. We'll measure the diameter of the nanotubes manufactured at that time period, and we'll record them in column 3 that we call diameter. Again, because Helix is very much concerned with the variability in those diameters, we are going to try to view the variation and see what we can learn about the variation by analyzing the data that we've collected there in column 3. There are standard data analysis packages that will allow you to carry out many different types of analyses on data. So once you've collected the data about your key quality characteristic, you'll go ahead and use a program such as Minitab to analyze that data and to learn from that data. The first pass at our analysis of this data might be a histogram. The histogram of the 60 data points that we collected on the diameters of these nanotubes will simply show the diameter reading that we took in the sample, and then how many times was that particular reading seen in the data set. We'll put those frequencies together with the diameters. We'll create the graphic called the histogram, and the histogram allows us to learn or visualize quite a bit about the diameters of the tubes we're manufacturing, including the variability in the diameter of the tubes that we're manufacturing. When we look at the histogram, basically we're going to learn 3 things about the nanotubes that we're producing and the diameters that we're making in our population of product that we're manufacturing. The first thing that we'll learn is about the mean of the process, the center of the process, or the center of the population, as we call it. So we learn that the center is somewhere between 1.36 and 1.4, and that the nanotubes will be a little bit larger than the center, a little bit smaller than the center. But if you were to ask me what the most common reading for our nanotubes diameters might be, I would say that the most common reading is going to be right here around the mean or the center. The second aspect of our nanotube diameters that we'll learn is we'll learn the width of the population. In other words, I expect nearly all the nanotubes that I'm producing to fall somewhere between a high value, a little bit above 1.52, and perhaps a lower value somewhere around 1.28. So we learn the width of the distribution, or the amount of variability in our output. And then finally, the third thing that we'll learn from the histogram is the shape of the distribution. The shape we most commonly look for is going to be our bell curve, a normal distribution. We're going to see that the data seems to follow a normal distribution, highly peaked in the center and then symmetrically falling about that center point. And so we'll go ahead and look at the histogram and decide that perhaps a normal distribution would be an appropriate model for all of the population of the diameters of these nanotubes. Our next step would then be to go ahead and fit a normal distribution to our data. To fit a normal distribution or a bell curve, as you see here, the bell curve is very easy to create because there are only two parameters that define a bell curve. The first parameter that defines a bell curve is called the mean. We've already discussed. And the mean is simply going to be adding each of the individual data points up. Here we have 60 data points. We add them all up, divide by 60, and we end up with a mean that we commonly use the notation X bar, average or a mean, in this case, 1.393. So the mean is going to describe the center of our population, the most likely value in our population. The center of the bell curve that describes our population will be seen in the mean. The second parameter that defines any normal distribution is called the standard deviation. The standard deviation is calculated by looking at each individual data point, subtracting the average data point from it, squaring those differences, and then summing up the squares, dividing by n minus 1, meaning you're averaging the squares, and then you take the square root of that sum. So the standard deviation allows us to know the second aspect of our bell curve, which is how far up will the bell curve go and how far down will the bell curve go. A normal distribution is width is described by the standard deviation because if we look along the width of the distribution will in general be no bigger than 3 standard deviations above the center and then 3 standard deviations below the center. So by knowing the standard deviation is 0.05673, knowing that S and the mean value, we can go ahead and draw our bell curve and know that that bell curve describes the population of our data. Now that we have a normal distribution, a normal model for our data, we can do all sorts of things. We can do all sorts of calculations with that information and calculate probabilities that are important to us. For example, let's have a look at the bell curve described by our data, our 60 nanotube diameters. The bell curve is again centered at the mean. It has a width of plus or minus 3 times the standard deviation. The probability distribution that you're seeing here can be mathematically described in the following equation. So here's a general equation for any normal distribution. And what you should notice about that normal distribution is that once you know two parameters, you can describe the probability function. In other words, if I look at this function, it has the mean in one spot. It has the standard deviation or sigma in the second spot. And once I know those two parameters, all the other parameters in the distribution are just constants. Once I know the distribution, I know what the probability function is. This allows me to do calculations such as the following. If I'm interested in calculating what percentage of my nanotubes have a diameter that is less than 1.36, once I know what the probability curve looks like, all I need to do is find that point on the curve, integrate the area under the curve from 1.36 or less, and then I can calculate that the probability of a nanotube diameter of 1.36 or less is about 18%. By knowing what the probability distribution function looks like, I can calculate any probability that's of interest to me. And this is going to be of value to us in calculating process capability, in calculating process control, and also doing statistics on shifts in the process that might occur. The second advantage to knowing what the normal distribution for your population is you know what spread of the distribution to expect. Here we see our normal distribution, again, centered at 1.393, has a variability that's a function of the standard deviation. And what we can learn from that is that if I am curious, what will be the distribution of my nanotube diameters, if I want to know where the majority of them will fall, I know that nearly 70% of my diameters are going to be between 1.4 plus 1 standard deviation and 1.4 minus 1 standard deviation. So most of my nanotubes are going to have a diameter that will fall in here. On the other hand, in many situations, I'm not interested in where most of my nanotube diameters are going to fall. I want a more complete picture. I want to know where almost all of my diameters are going to fall. Based on my normal distribution, I know that 96% or so of my nanotube diameters will fall between 1.4 plus 2 standard deviations. So now I'm adding this area under the curve and then minus 2 standard deviations. So in between my second sigma on the high side or 2 sigma on the low side, I know that 96% will fall. And then finally, the logic flows all the way out to 3 standard deviations. I know that nearly all of my tubes, 99.7%, will fall between plus or minus 3 standard deviations. So whenever it's called into account that I need to know where almost all of my diameters are going to fall, which we'll see we're going to use in a process capability calculation, I'll be able to take advantage of whatever percentage here, the 70, 96, or 99, or remember, we can calculate any probability that's of interest to us, no matter what the application. The next step, once we understand our normal distribution of our nanotube diameters, the next step is to compare those diameters and compare that variability to our customer's specifications. Now, Helix specified 1.2 to 1.5. I'm going to go ahead and start with a specification between 1.2 and 1.6, and we'll use that, and then we'll come back to Helix's specs of 1.2 to 1.5. The simplest and most straightforward way to answer the question, is my process capable of meeting my customer's specifications, is to calculate an index that we call CP. CP is just the ratio of the amount of room that my customer is giving me to work with. So if I look at the difference between the lower spec and the upper spec, that is the range of values that I'm allowed to have my nanotubes fall into and still meet customer requirements. The bottom of this denominator is how much room or the range that my process wants to take up. So this is the amount of variability being manufactured due to my process manufacturing variation. The CP just takes the ratio of those two. And as we can see in the diagram below, what I've tried to show is the ratio of the customer spec range in the specifications here to the amount of variation in my process, which is from here to here. For this particular example, by viewing the graphic, what we see is that the process variability, 6 standard deviations, and the customer spec range, everything between 1.2 and 1.6, are nearly identical. So if I look at the ratio for this process is approximately equal to 1. If the process variation and the spec range are equal, what I say is that my process is just barely capable. As we can see, every diameter in this distribution are all falling within the specifications, but just barely. I would like you to imagine what would happen if the process shifted to the high side or shifted to the low side, what would happen to the tail of that distribution? The tail of that distribution, either on the low or the high side, would move outside of the spec, and we would say the process was not capable. So what we're learning from this calculation in the diagram is that in order to say that my process is capable, my CP has to be a minimum of 1. Higher CP would be better, but I need to have at least a CP of 1. If I was to do a quick comparison of CP, as we see here, what I would notice is that if my process variation extended further outside my customer specification range, then my CP might be, as in this case, as low as 0.7. And what 0.7 is indicating to me is that I'm losing wear out of spec on the high end and the low end. My process is not capable. My CP is telling me that without having to see the diagram. So the CP calculation indicates to you whether your process is capable without having to see the actual histogram and the specs. We already covered the situation where the process variability was just equal to my customer specification range. That's a process that is just capable. And then finally, if the process specifications are much, much wider than the variability, so the variability goes to here, but I have room on either side, my process can then shift in the mean either high or low, and still I won't see the tails of the distribution go outside the specification where I don't want to see them. So a process that is very capable has a CP value much greater than 1, perhaps in this case 1.5. And 1.5 is a highly capable process. So here we see again, CP is used to answer the question, is my process capable of meeting my customer's specs? Now let's extend that logic to another scenario. Here I have another scenario where we've drawn a process that ranges from 1.2 to 1.6. So that's the process variability. The customer spec range in this example is between 1.6 and 2.0. If you look at the size of the variability and the size of the customer spec range, I'm still getting 1. However, is this process capable? This process couldn't be further from being capable. Every part is outside of the specs. The whole of the distribution is falling outside the specifications. So in this case, what we're learning is that CP is a great beginning. You have to have a CP of at least equal to 1, but CP isn't the end of the story. CP is just the beginning. Evidently, what we need to think about also is that where is the mean of this process? The mean of the process also has to be considered, as well as the amount of variability that we're seeing in the process. So what we need is a capability indice that will go ahead and relate the mean of the process to the specification and see how close to either one of those specs that we're following. We'll extend the logic of CP to an index called CPK. CPK is going to focus on the average of the process, so we need to worry about where's the center of the distribution, but it's also going to focus on the variability of the process. We can't have more variability than we can fit in the specifications. For example, if I look at the process shown below, the average or the mean or the center of the process is closer to the upper spec and it's further away from the lower spec. So to calculate CPK, what I would do is I would focus on this distance, which I see is approximately 0.1. I'll ballpark that to 0.1. And then I'll focus on not the full process variability, because I'm only looking at one half of the tolerance range or the customer spec range. I'm only going to look at one half of the process variation. So I'll look at 3 standard deviations, and I'll see that 3 standard deviations for a process that has a standard deviation of about 0.056 would be that I would divide by perhaps 0.16, and I would see that we are much less than a CPK of 1. So our CPK for this process is going to be less than 1. And we also see that the process is not capable of keeping all of our product within the specs. The upper end of the distribution is above the upper spec. So CPK has the same requirement. Your CPK must equal at least 1 in order to be able to say that your process is capable of meeting your customer's spec. So let's review. We'll look at CP and we'll look at CPK for our process. Here we had a mean that we see here, a standard deviation of 0.05673. We know our customer spec range for Helix was 1.2 to 1.5 nanometers. The CPK calculation takes the ratio of the spec range, divides it by the process variability, and tells us we have a process that has more variability than we can fit in the specifications. And then, as we estimated earlier, if I look at the distance to the closest spec, divide that by half of the process variability, I end up with a CPK that is less than 1, also indicating that the process is not capable. So the CP, as we learn, speaks only to variation. And then the CPK is going to look at the mean or the center and the variation. With that information in hand, let's go back one slide and have a look at what it means for a process that's centered. If the mean of the process was hitting exactly on the target value, now the target value is halfway between the upper spec and the lower spec. If the mean of your process is halfway between the target value, then the denominator of the CPK is going to have what value? The denominator will be the half of the process variability, and then the numerator of the CPK calculation will be one half of your process spec. Given that, what we see for a centered process, the process is centered, then what we learn is that CPK and CP become the same number. In this way, we see that CPK can never be greater than CP. It can only be equal to CP if the process is centered. And then when I see a CPK that is less than my CP, I know that my process must be off center. I'm closer to one spec or the other. So that's some important information to remember about CP and CPK. If I know what CP is, I know whether or not I have too much variation. And then if I know what CPK is and its relation to CP, I can answer the question, is my process centered or not? Now let's extend the concepts we've just learned to the long-term performance capability calculation that we call PPK. What we're going to find is that PPK and CPK are nearly identical. They have the same function. They have the same logic. There's just one small difference. The difference is that one of them uses a standard deviation that represents the long-term variability of the process, and the other one uses a standard deviation that represents the short-term variability of the process. So this is reflected in the PPK, and this is reflected in the CPK. How do we get a long-term and a short-term variability estimate from the same set of data? What I'd like you to imagine taking 20 data points from your process. So time is going this way. We're taking 20 data points over time, but we're not just taking them randomly over time. We're taking them in a special way that we call subgrouping. The way we subgroup our data for a long-term process capability study is that at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'll go out and sample my first 5 samples over a short amount of time. I might take 3 or 4 or 5 minutes to grab samples from my process. This is going to be at 8 in the morning. If I was to take the standard deviation of those 5 samples, they represent the short-term variation of my process because I didn't allow any long-term variation to show itself in that sample that was taken in just 5 minutes. Now, at noontime, at 12, I'm going to go back out in the process, and I'm going to take my next set of data, and the calculation of the standard deviation from my second subgroup of 5 will again represent the short-term variation in the process because I only took 5 minutes to sample those process. If I repeat the process at 4 o'clock and at 8 o'clock in the evening, what I've just done is I've collected 20 samples that allow me to estimate 2 different sources of variability in my process. Looking at the standard deviations calculated within the subgroup, standard deviation within, that we call standard deviation pooled, is an indicator of short-term variability, and then the standard deviation of all 20 data points is going to reflect what? The overall variation or the long-term standard deviation. Now, the way we average these 4 short-term variability values, S1 through S4, is we pool them. Pooling is a way of averaging standard deviations. The logic of averaging should work perfectly here. It's the same concept, only instead of averaging the actual S, we average S squared, we average the variances. By adding up all the variances together and then dividing by 4, I'm calculating the average variance, and then when I take the square root, then I'm taking the average standard deviation. So this is going to give me standard deviation short term, and then of course all 20 data points into the formula for us will give me standard deviation long term. The only difference between PPK and CPK is that PPK is meant to express the long-term variability in the process. It's considered a more realistic, a more process performance capability measure. And CPK represents the short-term variability in the process. It's often thought of as the best you can do, because after all, if you take samples over a very, very short amount of time, you really haven't given the process very much time to vary. So when I'm doing a long-term process capability study, the way I'm going to collect data for that study is I'm going to go ahead and take 5 samples in the morning together. I'll wait 4 hours. I'll take 5 samples again in what I call subgroup number 2, and so on and so on and so on. Now, there's nothing magical about the number 5 in the subgroup size, and there also is nothing magical about 4 hours. In general, you'll take a larger subgroup size if you have more short-term variation, and then the amount of time you wait between subgroups will be a function of what the time constant for your process is. If your process has a very, very slow drift to it, you're going to end up taking samples over a longer period of time to try to capture the variation to that long-term drift. On the other hand, if your time cycle for your process is very, very cyclic, highly cyclic, you're going to end up taking samples maybe shorter than every 4 hours, maybe every 2 hours or even 1 hour. So there's nothing magical about the times I've chosen. I'm just using those to express, using those as an example here. Now, how do we analyze the data? We're going to analyze the data to try to estimate CPK and PPK. To estimate CPK and PPK for a long-term process capability study, you need to meet the following 4 requirements. 2 of them are requirements, and then 2 of them are just data requirements. So you need to know what your specs are. You're going to compare it to the specs, And you need to collect data, as we said, over a long period of time, but definitely in subgroups. So those are your two data requirements. Now, your two assumptions about that data are, number one, that the process is in control. What we're going to learn in our next lecture is about what does it mean for a process to be in control, and how do I determine whether or not a process is in control. For now, what we'll mention is that one definition of process control is simply that the standard deviation of the process in the long term is the same number as the standard deviation from the process in the short term. In other words, if I take data from the process, it does not matter when I take the data. The bell curve that describes the process is unchanging. Therefore, it does not matter if I take a long-term sample or a short-term sample, I'm still going to get the same estimate for S. The second assumption about our data is that we're going to use the normal probability distribution to describe that data, so we need to assume that our data comes from a normal population. Once you've collected the data, as requested in number four here, you'll enter that data into a program such as Minitab. Minitab has an output called the Process Capability Six-Pack that allows you to do two things. It allows you to check, did I meet this assumption, and did I meet that assumption? So here we see the output of the process capability six-pack for our data set that we collected over a long period of time. You can see we have close to 48 subgroups here. So 48 times 4 hours is many days' time that we've allowed the process to vary. What we're seeing from this output is, number one, the histogram is showing us that familiar bell-shaped curve, so we'll use the histogram to confirm that our data is normally distributed. We'll see there's another way to estimate normality, which is called the normal probability plot. The normal probability plot is showing us a straight line to our data, indicating that the data follows a normal distribution. And we even have a statistical test called the Anderson-Darling test that is, again, confirming normality for our data set. So both of these two indicators are telling us our data does follow a normal distribution. We've met assumption number two outlined above. Assumption number three. Now, for assumption number two, we're going to go to a control chart. A control chart, very simply, looks at the short-term variability in your process, as indicated by the upper and lower control limits. The long-term variability in your process is indicated by the data points, the average data points. And what we're seeing is that nearly all those data points fall within those short-term capability limits, and therefore we'll conclude that our process is in control. Now, the process does go out of control slightly in a couple of data points that you see in red here and in red here, but I would say that the process is in control enough that we can go ahead and assume that we've met assumption number two, that the process must be in control. Now, once you've established that the process is in control, then we'll go to the next step. The next step, we'll say, we'll actually do the process capability calculation. The process capability report for Minitab tells us a number of interesting things about our process. Number one, since our process was in control, the standard deviation within and the standard deviation overall, that long-term and short-term process variability, turned out to be very, very close to the same number. Therefore, PPK and CPK turned out to be very, very similar estimates. Our process has about the same capability over the long term as it does over the short term, and that, of course, is your most ideal scenario. The other information we're learning is that our estimate of PP being approximately 1 tells us the variability in the process from the smallest diameters to the highest diameters is small enough to just fit inside my customer spec range. The fact that PPK is less than my PP estimate. You can see that here, the 0.67 is smaller than the 1.06. That's telling me that my process is off center. And then finally, the most important aspect of what we're going to learn from this analysis, what your manufacturing operation is going to be most interested in, is that we're estimating the total defect level to be about 3%, and we know that we're making about 3% outside the spec, probably above the upper spec here, and that the other 97% is in spec. So this is how we would calculate PPK and CPK. To summarize our understanding of PPK and CPK, I'll use this simple schematic diagram. You'll remember that when we were talking about PPK and CPK, and when we were talking about CP and CPK, there were two things that were important. Is the process centered, and is the process in control? If the process is in control and it's centered, which we see here, you'll see CPK and PPK will be the same value, and that CPK and CP will be the same value. So when you see that in that relationship in the three numbers, you know that the process is in control and that it is appropriately centered. Now, if the process is off center, you're going to see a CPK value that's less than your CP value. And this is telling you that the most beneficial adjustment to the process would be to try to adjust the center of the process down to wherever the target is at, whether it needs to go up to the target or down to the target. On the other hand, if your process is out of control, what you'll see is that the CPK and the PPK numbers will no longer be equal. The PPK can never be any larger than the CPK. The CPK is your best case scenario. After all, the amount of variability over the short term is the best your process can do. Now, if your process is both out of control and off center, you're going to end up with a CPK that's smaller than CP and a PPK that's smaller than CPK. So that one diagram kind of summarizes our understanding of the relationships between those capability indices. So what's an acceptable CPK level for any process? Well, the key to CPK is that CPK tells you how many defects you're manufacturing. This simple table tells us that if we dive down well below one, we're talking about a process that has approximately 3.5 to 4% defect level. On the other hand, if we have a CPK of one, then our defect level is a fraction of a percent, very small fraction of a percent. And then some processes require extremely high CPK values because their tolerance for defects, because of the demand of the process, is so high that they require a CPK level that is head and shoulders above what other manufacturing operations are required to meet. Some general benchmarks to think about might be safety in the airline industry. If I was to look at safety in the airline industry, there's no room for error there. A CPK of two or even more might be required because they're looking for parts per million or even parts per billion defects levels for safety. That doesn't mean that the airline industry, the whole operation works under those kind of requirements. If I was to look at the requirements for getting your bag there on time or even getting your bag there at all, we all know that a lot of airlines operate at a CPK maybe around 0.4, 0.5 or so. They might have a 10% late rate for baggage or a non-arrival rate. Industries like the pharmaceutical industry, again, a critical product and critical demands, they're going to have a much higher CPK requirement. The automotive industry usually works to a standard of about 1.33. And then finally, a typical manufacturing organization might operate around a CPK of about 1, with this level of defects being acceptable for a lot of different situations. Now, what level of CPK will be needed for nanoscale manufacturing? That's going to depend on the process, depend on the product, and that'll be something that you'll be thinking about in the future to be able to answer that question. Hopefully, you've been given the knowledge you need to be able to make those decisions for whatever manufacturing processes are in store for you in the future. To sum up, we're going to go ahead and decide that variation is very important to product quality, and companies that are looking to improve product quality are going to be looking to minimize variation. In minimizing variation and understanding it, we start off with graphical analysis, and then we use a normal model to model the data and the variation and understand the variation. We compare that variability to the customer specifications by using CPK and CP. Those two indexes will allow us to decide whether the variation is too wide, decide whether the process is centered or both, and then if we really need to assess our long-term process capability, we'll go ahead and do a complete study and calculate our PPK, our performance long-term process capability index.